Let's take our Bibles. We're going to go to Exodus chapter 3 this morning. Exodus chapter 3. We're going to look at the last half of this chapter. We've looked at the first half before. Beginning down in verse 13, we'll read through the end of the chapter and we'll launch into things this morning. And Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'Well, what is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'Yahweh, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice. And you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, Yahweh, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now, please, let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So, or in this way, you shall plunder the Egyptians." This week we've noted a cultural shift that's been foisted upon the American people by 5 Supreme Court justices. It seems just a little bit simplistic to go back to a time when television was instructing hearts with just a measure of virtue, with such stories as The Lone Ranger. I know that it was a series that was developed for the radio back in the 1930s. It was developed for television back in the 1950s. But I remember seeing enough of the episodes to know that at the end of The Lone Ranger's stories, it always ended the same. Usually there were 2 characters standing and watching as the Lone Ranger and generally Tonto with them were galloping off into the distance, and one would turn to the other and say to the other one, "Who was that masked man?" Right? You remember seeing that enough times. The masking of characters is just, it's been a part of storytelling for a long time. Often it defines the very plot. You think of the Broadway play, The Phantom of the Opera. The whole masking of the main character kind of drives the plot. A few lines within these stories, those stand out, as well as the 1980s classic, The Princess Bride. As they're in their sword fight, the one turns to the masked man in black and says, "Who are you?" To which he responds, "No one of consequence." They continue, "I must know. Get used to disappointment." They stop their sword fight so they can have this stupid little dialogue, and then they're, okay, and then they're back to sword fighting. Okay, it comes out later he's the dread pirate Roberts, but he's also the farm boy who's come to rescue his princess bride. The purpose of the mask is always to veil. It's to hide, and the story, when the unveiling happens, it's always climactic. That is, it always supplies the single element in the story upon which the story turns. None of the story is the same after the mask has been taken off. As Moses encounters God at the burning bush, we're given the rare opportunity in Scripture to peer behind the mask. And what we see is there's a God like no other. For just a moment, God peels back the mask, and it's God Himself who has to do the peeling. Nobody can reach up and take the mask off of God. It comes early in the storyline, but this event is climactic in nature in that God himself will draw attention to this fact that this is unique, that he gets to reveal himself by his name in a unique way. He's going to draw attention to that again in chapter 6. In one of the Bible's most enigmatic encounters, one of the most veiled encounters, what we're going to see is that the self-disclosure of God is best understood as an invitation to greater disclosure. When you come and you look at this story, I think we're going to find three things by which God is defined. As we look at this, one writer says, one of the most striking aspects of this account of God revealing his name to Moses is the fact that God, in fact, revealed his name to Moses. And as he does, God tells Moses that the most important thing about his brand new mission is none other than God himself. God's in the middle of revealing himself to a man that he calls to be used to forward a story that is God's story. And as he does this, there's different ways by which God defines himself and gives himself to his people. The first of these is this. God is defined by his ways. That is, he's defined by who he is intrinsically. We see there, verse 13, Moses has just been called. He says, God, I'm nothing. Who am I? God says, it's okay, Moses. I'm going to go with you. Here's what I want you to do. I'm sending you. I'm going to go with you to bring out my people. Verse 13, Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel, as if he has a choice, okay, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. As God gives his name to Moses in three words here, I am what or that or who I am, he gives Moses, he pulls back the curtain, he gives Moses a lot. But in the middle of this giving, it's one of those things where you wonder, what is it that I just got out of this? I am who I am, Philip Ryken says, is the kind of statement that raises more questions than it answers. That's because I am who I am speaks of the mystery of God. Who is this God? Who is this masked God? Moses, I am who I am. Okay. Thank you, but that's still a mystery. Pharaoh's going to ask a question. Who is this God that I should listen to him? Okay. God says, I thought you'd never ask. I've been waiting to show you who I am. And then for several chapters, God is going to stretch out his hand and he's going to give a personal tutorial to none other than the leader of the world at that time, the greatest nation on planet Earth. And he's introducing Pharaoh to himself, this mysterious God, this God who's defined by none other than himself. It speaks of the mystery of God. This word, this name speaks of the immutability of God. Immutability is a big word that just means God doesn't change. I am. I am what I am. He gives it in the present tense. It's an eternal present. With God, there is no was or will be. He's always there. When we speak of him, when the angels speak of him, we read in the book of Revelation, he's the God who was, who is to come. When Jesus introduces himself, let's go there for a second. Revelation chapter 1, verse 8. John sees Jesus. Verse 8, I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is, who was, and who is to come, the Almighty. The one who, and he changes up the order, the one who is, and
was and is still coming. Up in chapter 4, verse 8, it says, I'm the one who was, it kind of lays it out in the same sequence that we would think of in time. Jesus is defending himself before the men of Israel. They're talking to him about Abraham. Remember the dialogue in John chapter 8, where they said, you're not even 50 years old. Have you met Abraham? What's wrong with you? They're kind of asking him in a sarcastic tone. You're an idiot. What do you think you are? You're not even 50 years old, and you say you've seen Abraham. How does Jesus answer? Before Abraham was, I... He doesn't say, I was. He says, I am. This whole thing belongs to me. Time, I'm bigger than it. I created time. I existed when there was no time. What do you measure time by? Things that move, planets, space, sequence, events. God was, God is, this eternal present. And what God was, God is. And what God is, God will be in the future. That's why it says in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. I don't think we can get it in our heads. I can't anyway. God is. And he always is what he is. There's never becoming anything more of what he is. If God were becoming more God, that means he's less God today than he will be tomorrow. And that can't happen. God's God. And there's never going to be a time when he's going to be less, and there's never going to be a time that he's more. There's never going to be a time when he's different than what he is. He's unchangeable. He's God. It speaks of the self-sufficiency of God. Why is God? What's the answer to that question? Why is God who he is? God is God because God is God. That's you can't go any farther than that. Philosophers have wrestled for centuries. Okay? So things continue to change. Things continue to move. If we go back and back and back and back and back, finally we have the unmoved mover, the thing by which everything else finds its definition. You push back as far as you can push. Why is God? It's a dumb question. God is. God. And you start working through this. It's like thinking, when did time start? How back was eternity in the past? You ever stop and think about how long eternity is in the future? So Katie Schultz just entered into God's presence. How long is she going to be with God? Forever. Okay. What's she going to do? No idea. You ever think about being with God forever? What are you going to do forever? Oh, man, sometimes I have a hard time filling an afternoon. I'm going to think of what I'm going to do forever. You get these mental gymnastics in your head, you get a headache. God is. And there's no reason for God, just God is. God is because he's self-existent. And anything that exists finds its existence in God. When we come up to Revelation chapter 4, where it talks about the God who is, who was, who is to come, the angels are around the throne and they're saying, God, worthy are you to receive all glory and honor and praise because you're the one who created everything. And because of your pleasure, your goodwill, everything exists. Because you're the first existent one. You're the all-existent one. We've seen a small picture of this in this fire from which God is speaking at this moment to Moses. This burning bush. This brilliant fire that is feeding on nothing and consuming nothing. It needs no fuel to light up. It just lights up because it is. And it's a picture, a symbol of God. Whereas God is getting Moses off his mind, off of something at this point. Look back in your text. Verse 10. Moses, come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" God said, "Moses, I'll be with you, and this thing shall be a sign for you that I've sent you. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you're going to serve me on this mountain." So Moses says to God, okay, God, let's say that I do this. If I come to the people, and if I say to them this, and they ask me what's his name, what am I supposed to say? How many times does Moses focus on himself in this question? God, if I come, if I say to them, and they ask me, what shall I say to them? Where is Moses focusing at this point? On Moses at this point, isn't he? God says, "Moses, okay, you're focusing entirely too much on yourself. I want you to get your eyes off of you, and I want you to get your eyes on me. Is this a huge thing I've asked you to do?" "Yes." "Okay, but I'm not asking you to do it by yourself. I am going with you. Me, the one who is, the one who exists by himself." And whereas Moses is still concerned about what people think of him, God reorients Moses' perspective to be consumed with the one who is what he is in and of himself. "Moses, you may be nothing, but I am everything. And I'm going with you. Is this too big for you?" "Yes." "So let me be all that you aren't. I am who I am." God says, "I'm the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Say this to the people of Israel, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me. This is my name forever. By this, I'm to be remembered." When God takes up the name of Abraham, God connects himself to this man. "I'm Abraham's God." He connects himself to Isaac. "I'm Isaac's God. I belong in a unique way and in an exclusive way to Jacob as his God." You look back on the life of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob. Each one of these men had a relationship in their dependence on God where something special is brought out. I think what God is saying here is that God is the God of those who walk by faith, like Abraham. That's why up in Romans chapter 4, God can say, "Abraham was the father of all who believe, of all who walk by faith, whether Jews or Gentiles. He receives the circumcision after he receives his justification so that he can be the father of all who walk by faith." God is the God of those who walk by faith just like he did for Abraham, just like he was for Abraham. In Isaac, we see that God is the God of those who are the children of promise, Galatians chapter 4, where we have the, not a parable, but the allegory of the free woman and the slave woman. And Paul says to those who are Christians, he says, "Listen, you're not children of the slave woman. You're not children of the flesh. You're children of promise. Just like Isaac was the child of promise, you, every one of you who've placed your trust in Jesus Christ and God has rebirthed from the inside out, you're a child of promise. God is the God of Abraham because he's the God of all who walk by faith. God is the God of Isaac because he's the God of all who are children of promise. God is the God of Jacob because he's the God of all who inherit the blessing." You go through the story with Abraham. Is he going to have a son? Is he not going to have a son? Is he going to have a son? Uh-oh, here comes Pharaoh. Ooh, what's going to happen? Oh, shoo, he has a son. You come to Isaac. Is he going to have a son? Is he not going to have a son? Oh, he's got two. Now what's going to go on? Oh. You come to Jacob, and he's got 12. Okay, he starts to have them. Okay. You come to the beginning of Exodus, and the sons become the people of Israel. Jacob begins to get what God had already promised. Just slices, and then Jacob, and he won't let go. He won't let go until God blesses him. And what does God do? He names him Israel because you've striven with God and you've succeeded. You get the blessing. I'm the God of all who walk by faith, not by sight. That's why Romans chapter 1, verse 17 says, "For all the just shall live by faith." Their God is the God of those who walk by faith. God is the God of all who are children of the promise. God is the God of all who ultimately and finally inherit the blessings. God says, don't you forget this. This is who I am. These are my ways. Look at the life of Abraham. Look at the life of Isaac. Look at the life of Jacob. Know how I interacted with them, because what I was for them, I will be for you. Because I am who I am. What I was, I am today, and I will be tomorrow. God is defined by who He is. He's this God who's high and lifted up. He's transcendent. He's this God who is perfect in and of Himself. He needs us not. He doesn't need anything added to Him in order for Him to be more of what He already is. At the same time, He's a God who's imminent, a God who comes close, a God who extends Himself in relationship to His people. What a beautiful balance in this transcendent, imminent, distant, close, huge God who lives inside of us. What an amazing mystery when we come to this God. We see, secondly, that God is defined by His works. Now, I wrestled with whether to use the word He's defined by His ways, but He's revealed by His works. But it really doesn't matter, because with us, there's a difference between who I am and what I do. Paul says, listen, I don't do the things that I want to do. I do the things that I don't want to do. Inside, I've got this wrestling. I'm this guy, but I'm sometimes this guy, and I'm sometimes this guy. With God, God's never different than who He is. So everything God does, He does because God is who He is. With God, there's no difference between being and doing. With us, there is. That's why as we work out our salvation, God says, now you have been justified, you have been converted, you have been changed. The old things have passed away. Everything has been made new in you. Now, because you are different, do different. With God, there's no anything that goes before. Okay? He is what He does. He does what He is. And we're going to see in a moment that He says what He is. He says what He does. All of these things are the same with God. So it's appropriate to say that God is defined by His works. That is, He's defined by what He does. In verses 16 and 20, we see, He says to Moses, here's what I want you to do. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what's been done to you. And I promise that I will, and He goes on and continues. But He starts out by saying, listen, here's what I've done. Here's what I do, here's what I am doing, here's what I've done up to this point. I have heard, I have observed. We go back to chapter 2, end of the chapter, verses 24 and 25. We saw four verbs that are connected specifically to God. It says, God heard. God remembered. God saw. God knew. This God who is who He is, who doesn't need me, He thinks about me. He listens to me. He observes me. Look at how it says it here in verse 16. It says, He's appeared to me saying, I have observed you, and everything that has been done to you outside the promised land, in the place where you don't fit, in the place where it doesn't seem like it's working for you, because it's not. What a comfort. Why should I go to God? Because He is who He is. An amazing God. Why should I get to know God? Because this is the kind of God that he is. He's a God who takes an interest in me. That's why John 3:16 is such a beautiful verse. For God so loved the world. What's wrong with this God? Doesn't he know what this world is? Doesn't he know what this world does? Why would he love this world? He loves this world because he sees, he hears, he remembers, he knows. In fact, is it Psalm 139 where it talks about this God thinks about me, and if I were to number it, it was more than the sands on the sea. This God thinks about me, and he knows me intimately. He uses the same word that's used of Adam coming in and knowing his wife in an intimate way, in a way that nobody else knows. God knows me intimately. That's why it's such a blessing when you come to the book of Romans and you find out that sometimes when I'm praying and I can't put it into words, it's just... The Bible says, because God lives inside my heart, he takes my groanings that I can't even utter. And he knows. And he unscrambles it and he interprets it. And he thinks about it and he processes it. And he comes to a decision about it and says, this is what you need right now. What a God. This God that's unapproachable. In fact, as he's coming up to the bush, God says, Moses, close enough. Take your shoes off. Don't come any closer. Yeah. Wasn't going to. But this God thinks about us. You look in chapter 3, verse 8. He says, I've seen. Verse 7. I've seen their affliction of my people. I've heard their cry. I know their sufferings. And then look at verse 8. And I have come down to deliver them. What a God! This God who's transcendent, this God who's high, who's holy, who even makes the ground holy when he arrives on the scene, this God comes down. We have the most perfect picture of that when we have Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, God with us. And he comes down, he's born of a virgin, and he's laid in a manger, a sweet-smelling thing, right? Put a manger in your house, you'll be walking out with it very shortly. Our God comes down. What kind of a God is this? This is a different God than any other of the gods that are going to be judged in a few chapters throughout the book of Exodus in the land of Egypt. Look at verse 15 and 16. What does this God do? God says, Moses, you need to tell them your story. I want you to tell them that I've appeared to you in verse 16. And then I want you to tell them that I have sent you. Did God need Moses to take his people out of Israel? Couldn't God just kind of like alakazam and go out with the cloud and say, okay, come on, folks, follow me. Did God need Moses? Are we awake this morning? Okay, God did not need Moses. Does God need you and me? God doesn't need you and me. But does God want to use us? Why? Because he is who he is. What kind of a God would make this microscopic sinner and then choose to use him to accomplish his purposes on planet Earth? I don't get it. But I get my God. This is a God. He says, Moses, you've got to tell him your story. Tell him that I've come down, that I've shown up, that I've appeared to you, and that I've called you. I've called you to be in my employment, and I've sent you to them. You are my minister, Moses. Verse 17, here's what I want you to tell them. I want you to tell them that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt. Yay! No more whips. No more rods. No more beatings. No more sand. No more clay. No more straw. We're done with that. Praise the Lord. I will bring you up out of. But whenever you go up out of, you're going in a direction towards something, right? So he finishes the statement and says, here's what I'll do. I'll bring you out of. I'll also bring you out to, up to the land of Canaan. Let me describe it a little bit for you. It's a land that flows with milk and with honey. Okay? I don't like milk. So I don't know that I'd want to go there. That's not the point. The point is, no cattle will ever be lacking for food to eat. Okay, I don't like milk, but I like beef. Okay, that's good. All right? So a land flowing with beef and honey. Well, I'm into that. The whole point is, nothing of the cattle will be wrong. They'll have plenty of them. There'll always be enough sustenance. And everything, whether it's living or whether it's made by something that's living, or if it's dependent on God who is there. And God is bringing you to a place where you can have this abundance of life. Jesus says in John chapter 10, I have come that they might have life, and that they might have it just barely, abundantly. Abundantly. This is the kind of God that we have. Who is this God? Who is this masked God? He's defined by who he is. He's defined by what he does. Verse 20. Verse 19. I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go, Moses, unless he's compelled by a mighty hand. Boy, I wonder who has a hand. Oh, I got it. Verse 20. I think I'll stretch out my hand. I'll stretch out my hand and I'll strike Egypt. The word strike here is the same verb that's used of Moses when he struck down the Egyptian who was striking down the Hebrew. Okay. God says, Moses, 40 years ago you were trying to do my job, striking down. It's not that it didn't need to be done, but I'm the one who has to do it. Okay, Moses, let me do my job because I can do it. I'll do it through you, but I'll do it without you. I'll be the one who gets the glory for this, Moses, not you. I'll stretch out my hand, I'll strike Egypt, and I'll strike them, the word is wonders, I'll strike them with the wonders that I will do there. The word wonders, Walter Brueggemann defines as extraordinary acts of power that violate all present construction of reality, so that God makes possible what the world thinks is impossible. Moses, I'm going to work in such a way that nobody can get credit for what I do except me. Why? Because I'm that kind of a God. When I send darkness over the whole land of Egypt, I'm gonna do it in a donut. Okay? So that the whole land is dark except where Goshen is. When I send the flies and the lice, I'm going to send it so everything is affected except where my people are. When I send the hail, when I send the lightning, I'm going to send those storms over the entire region, and then I'm going to make a comma and it's going to go all around but just my people. I'm going to turn the water to blood. I'm going to make frogs. I'm going to bring locusts. I'm going to do things that nobody else can do, and they're going to say so. They can't do it. This must be the hand of God. I'm going to do wonders, Moses. Why? Because I can. Because I'm God. Because I want this people to know what kind of a God that I am. And that's really what he says. I want Egypt to know that I am who I am. God's defined by what he does. God's defined by who he is. Finally, God's defined by what he says. He's defined by his word. His ways, his works, his words. And again, God only says what he says because he is who he is. You want to find out what kind of a God God is? Listen to what he says. That's the whole point behind the Ten Commandments. We could never accomplish them, but we understand what kind of a God God is. And we understand what kind of a people we are. We're so different from our holy God. But listen to what God says. God speaks, and in speaking, both God and his people are set apart. Let's go up to the book of Deuteronomy for just a moment. Deuteronomy chapter 4. The fact that God talks sets him apart from all other gods. In the book of Psalms, it talks, it mocks. These gods have ears, but they don't hear. These gods have mouths, but they don't talk. They have feet, but they can't walk. Our God can do all of these things. He hears, he talks, he sees, he goes, he comes. Deuteronomy chapter 4, he's going to focus especially on the fact that God speaks. Verse 1, "Now Israel, listen to the statutes, the rules that I'm teaching you," Moses says. "Do them so you can live and go in and take possession of the Lord, the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving to you. Don't add to the word that I command you. Don't take away from the word that I command you. So you can keep the commandments that aren't from me, but they're from the Lord your God that I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are still alive today. Now see, listen, look, I've taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do these rules in the land that you're entering to take possession. Keep these rules, do these rules, because this will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of all peoples, who when they hear all these statutes will say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.' What nation is there that has a God so near to it as Yahweh, our God, is to us whenever we call upon him? What great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you?" Where did they get this law? Down to verse 12. "The Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form. There was only a voice." Verse 15, "Therefore watch yourselves very carefully, since you saw no form on that day, the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb, out of the midst of the fire." Look at verse 33. "Did any people ever hear the voice of a God speaking out of the midst of the fire, like what you've heard, and still live?" Verse 36. "Out of heaven, God let you hear his voice so that he might train you, discipline you. And on earth, he let you see his fire, and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire." Listen, you're a different kind of people because you have a different kind of God. You have a God who talks to you. You have a God who made you. You have a God who thinks about you. You have a God who comes close to you. This God speaks, he interacts, he expects, he requires, he says. You don't have to wonder about this God because he can tell you what he's thinking. And you're responsible for it. What an amazing God. God speaks, and it sets both him and his people apart. God speaks, and in speaking, he relates himself to his people. Back in our text, Exodus chapter 3, verse 15, God said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me. This is my name forever. In this way, in this manner, by this name that I've just given you, I will be remembered. I want you to remember me by the name that I've just spoken to you.'" God relates himself to his people. God ties his name to the people of his promise, the fathers, because God himself is a God of promise to his people. "Moses, I want you to understand who I am. I'm the God who promised Abraham and Isaac and Jacob so many descendants that they're more numerous than the skies of heaven and the sands on the seashore. I want you to tell them that I'm the God of the promise, because these are the people that I promised to them. They're the result of my promise. And what I was for them, their fathers, I will be for them as a people. I want you to tell these people that they, in fact, are the fulfillment of my promise." And I want them to know that I'm a promising God, because up in verse 17 he says, "And I promise you this, that I'm going to do more for you. I'm not done. I'm not done promising. I'm not done talking. I'm not done giving. I'm saying more that I will do, and I will do it for you. For you." God speaks, and in speaking, he relates himself to his people. God promises his people. When God promises something, he says, "Guys, I am who I am. I need nothing to be. And I don't need anything to exist to make something exist." That's in Romans chapter 4, verse 17. It says, "He who exists calls into existence what never existed before." Go through this text real quick. Look at verse 17. God says, "I will do this. I will bring you up out. I will bring you up to." Verse 18. "When you go, they will listen to you, Moses. I know they will." How do you know, God? "Moses, I said they will. They will." Up in verse 19. "Moses, when you come to Pharaoh, he will not." Well, how do you know he won't? "Moses, I said he won't. He won't." Up in verse 20. "And because he won't, so I will." Then verse 21. "And I will." Verse 22, "you shall not." Verse 22, "but you shall." Verse 22, "and in this way you shall." All of a sudden, God is laying out a story for Moses. It says, this is what's going to happen, and this is what's going to happen next. And because this doesn't happen, I'm going to do this, and then this will happen. How does God know? How can God be so sure of this? God can be so sure of this because God is. And when God speaks, he calls into existence what never existed. That's the kind of God he is. The God who knows the end from the beginning. God speaks and shows that he knows the end from the beginning. Isaiah 46 verses 9 and 10 says, "I am God. There's no other. I'm God, there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, from ancient times, things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand. I will accomplish all my purpose." Moses is at a spot that one day he was just bringing a bunch of sheep. He had no idea what kind of ground he was standing on. God shows up and he finds out it's holy ground. But the holiest of ground is when God becomes unmasked. When God pulls back the mask just a little bit and says, "This is who I am." God sometimes uses things that we wouldn't choose. The pain, the suffering, the trial, the weight. And says, "Listen, all I'm trying to do is get you to know me better." When God shows up, he speaks to Moses, and Moses, "I am who I am." "Well, thanks. What does that mean?" I like how Philip Ryken says, "The rest of Exodus is the story of God living up to his name. Moses, let me show you who I am. Pharaoh, let me show you who I am." Maybe better than the book of Exodus. Maybe the rest of eternity is God living up to his name. Because when you come down to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 7, it says, you know what? God is going to take delight and pleasure in showcasing what kind of a God he is forever as he pours out his kindness on you. What an amazing God. But when God shows up in your life and he says, "This is who I am," he's never done. He can never give you all of who he is. It requires you to walk with him so you get to know him more and more. When God reveals himself to you, it's less of a revelation and it's more of an invitation. It's a further up and further in. And further up and further in. I wonder, as you interact with your God today, are you getting to know him better? Or was it a once and done meeting for you? Okay, met God, cross that one off my list. You're missing the point. When you meet God, He calls you into an eternal relationship of getting to know Him better. Because you'll never know all the beauty that our God is. Let's pray.